This all started in museums and galleries. Now it's in classrooms, in country towns.
This should not be here.
It's a human being in a box.
This is the stuff of empires.
There is a great betrayal.
We're not slaves, we're African.
It's the stuff the British stole.
I just don't believe that. It just does not stand up.
From ABC Australia and CBC Podcasts, 6 brand new podcast episodes for free worldwide, available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Q. Before we get going today, I want to let you know, if you're not already following our podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, drop us a follow. It means a lot. All right, let's get going. What's your memory of going to, like, video stores? If you're of a certain age, it might have been a weekly ritual. Walking in, smelling the popcorn, trying to win a black gumball for a free rental, wondering what was going on behind the beaded curtain in the back. When Christian Sparks was growing up in St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador, a place I hear is very nice, he would do this deal at Allen's Video in St. John's. I bet you have one like this in your hometown too. It was 7 movies for 7 nights for $7.77. Good deal, right? Well, it was deals like that and local video stores that led him to become one of the most talked about Canadian filmmakers right now. Christian's latest film, The King Tide, is set in Newfoundland and Labrador on a remote island without a TV, much less a video store. And it centers on a young girl who is washed ashore on the eve of the King Tide into a remote island community in Newfoundland. And this girl turns out to have mystical powers. When community members spend time with her, they're healed from their illnesses, from their old age, even from their hangovers. As a result, the community removes itself from the outside world, and when the girl's powers dissipate, the community starts to fall apart violently. It's powerful. It's an eerie film. The Globe and Mail called it a film that sends you out of the theater shaken yet also thrilled. I got to see it at the Toronto International Film Festival. I thought it was a really dark, powerful depiction of our home province, very different than the tourism ads. The King Tide is getting a wide release right now. And Christian Sparks, the director, joined me from St. John's. Congratulations on the film. I really did love it.
That's great. I'm glad you could attend that first screening at TIFF. It's always great, you know, to premiere at home with a bunch of friends and family. Have some homers in the audience. It goes a long way.
My understanding is, am I right that you don't watch the films, though? You're nowhere to be found?
I don't know. I just pace around and just stare at myself in the mirror in the bathroom and wait for it to be over.
I can relate to you. I don't listen to the interviews. I can't do it. But I'm not the one being interviewed, so I can ask you, why not?
You know, like with most artists, you spend so much time making the thing, you're sick to death of it by the time it finally comes out. And, you know, I take it that extra step. For me, I know I'm not going to enjoy it, and I'm afraid that my distaste for it is going to spread throughout the audience one by one and infect all the audience members. So to avoid that happening, I just remove myself.
Hold on. You're distaste for the film?
Yeah.
What, the distaste for the thing you made?
I know. It takes a couple of years for me to be able to kind of watch it and accept it. I'll come across it. Someone will ask for a clip or some festival or something. Someone wants to talk about it, and I'll dig it up and I'll look at it. I'm like, this is acceptable. And then I just move on.
So what made you want to be a filmmaker in the first place? Like, there are not many roads to filmmaking with growing up in Newfoundland. Are St. John's, you grew up in St. John's?
Yeah, I grew up in St. John's next to Boring Park there, for people who know, in the west end of town. I was always the biggest film buff out of all of my friends. It was kind of always my thing. My bedroom walls were kind of covered in posters. I would go write my name on movie posters at the local Allen's, you know, the Topsail Road one with the 7 for $7.77.
That was my Allen's too. That was my video store. For people who don't know, it was 7 movies for, see if I get this right, 7 movies for 7 nights for $7.77.
Absolutely. And, you know, as a Newfoundland kid, you would bundle up in your snowsuit and make the half-day pilgrimage from the West End through Concrete Products, across the river, up over the hill, and you'd finally arrive at Allen's and thaw out and spend 2 hours picking movies, and then you just watch the hell out of them for the next week. And that was a real kind of film education for me. And, You know, my father was a painter, a well-known Newfoundland painter named Ian Sparks, and painting and drawing was always my thing. So I went away to NASCAD, the art college on the East Coast, and I figured I might do graphic design because, you know, film never occurred to me. I didn't know anyone who did it or owned a camera, so it just never occurred to me. And then my first semester, I was in the lunchroom and someone said, did you hear they're getting a film program next semester? And the moment I heard that, I never questioned it. I was like, that's exactly what I'm going to do. And so I did a four-year program and came home and started writing short films on my own, made them with friends, and, you know, one thing led to another.
Why was it important that you come home? I don't mean to be too much of a homer here, but mm-hmm. what I find interesting about your work is that I read an interview in the Telegram where you talked a lot about how centering Newfoundland and Newfoundland stories is important to you. So right after you go to film school, you come home right away.
Well, part of the reason I came home right away was because I was broke.
Yeah, right.
You know, you got no money, so you got to go back to mom and dad's place. You got to mooch for a couple more years.
For sure, for sure.
And, you know, I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do. And, you know, I always had a bunch of good friends home. And so I figured I would go home, get a job, make some money, and then figure out what I wanted to do next. And there was a local company called Pope Productions, run by Paul Pope. And they just happened to be making TV shows at the time. And I got a job there. And shortly after, got a job at another company called Best Boy. And met a great friend of mine named Allison White, who's a film producer. She was just fresh out of film school at the time. And she came into Best Boy looking for an editing job. And she got the job and we became fast friends. And we made a short film together called The River in the Woods, about a group of kids that find a monster in the woods and befriend it, and then he turns on him at the end of the day. So, you know, like all my other films, everyone dies in the end. And so, you know, I just had a great relationship with her, and I enjoyed working at home. And little by little, I kind of realized that, you know, even though that story was about monsters, the subsequent stories that I made were about Newfoundland. And you know, when I went away to school, I couldn't get away from Newfoundland quick enough. But a couple of years go by and something funny happens. You realize that, you know, where you're from gives you a very unique perspective. And I was suddenly much more interested in Newfoundland and telling Newfoundland's story because it gave me something to say. You know, if you're from St. John's, you're different from someone from Kitchener or wherever it may be. Not that there's anything wrong with those places, but, you know, Newfoundland is certainly different.
But around that time, I guess things are changing right now with the amount of TV production that's happening in Newfoundland and Labrador. But did being a filmmaker seem like a career path that was an option for you in St. John's?
I think it always did for me, just because I always had faith that I could do it. I always felt like if I worked hard and stuck to it, that I could make a go of it. You know, like a lot of things, if you get encouraging signs early on, if you make a film or two and it plays big festivals and people tell you it's pretty good, wins a few awards, signs show you that you're on the right track. So I had done that fairly early, and I felt pretty confident in what I was doing. And it was just a matter of, you know, just trying to work really hard and raising the funding. And yeah, I've been lucky, I got to say, to carve out a career in film in St. John's. It's not easy.
I should also say there's a really strong sort of community around film in St. John's. People look out for one another and support one another.
They absolutely do. And I mean, as you know, part of the reason I stayed too is just because the best storytellers I knew and the best writers I knew were around there. You know, I've recently made a film, Sweetland, based on a Michael Crummy novel. I made my first film, Cast No Shadow, based on a novella by Joel Thomas Hines. And I like to write. And, you know, I wrote a film called Hammer and I adapted Michael's novel. But I'm aware that there's other people who are better at it than I am. And in Newfoundland, we just have a bunch of great writers. And so, you know, to me, those are the people I have the most reverence for. And I've just been lucky to collaborate with them at home.
Though this is an interesting story in The King Tide, and that's a story set in Newfoundland and about an isolated community in Newfoundland. But it was developed by two writer friends of yours who are not from Newfoundland, William Woods and Albert Shin. So what drew you to the script when you read it for the first time? Put me in the chair with you, with the script in front of you, with the paper or the PDF or whatever. And what was going through your mind?
Well, right away, it felt like a fairly commercial. It was a genre film with a fairly big canvas. The themes and ideas that it was dealing with didn't feel like indie film to me. It felt like a fairly propulsive thriller. And like, I think a lot of the best genre films, they have more on their mind than they let on. Like, so they work very well by entertaining you first. But the deeper you get into the story, you realize, oh, my God, this is actually about something rich and interesting. And there's lots of things you can draw from The King Tide. Like, it's easy to see it as a bit of an environmental parable, for example. You know, like Isla, it's easy to see her kind of as Mother Earth. You know, it's about faith and fanaticism and the dangers of kind of what happened when we believe in something too strongly and don't see opposing views. I mean, it's not hard to see parallels between or in our modern world. So, you know, it had some rich modern world context and themes that I could sink my teeth into while also taking place in a culture and a people that I knew very well.
Isla isn't just a gifted child.
Tina.
Many thanks to you, Isla.
She's much greater than that.
Many thanks to you, Isla.
She was delivered to us on this island on the eve of the King Tide.
You ready?
This character Isla mysteriously appears, as I mentioned, in this incredibly isolated community as a baby. And over time, the town discovers she has these magical healing powers, and the town decides to sort of cut off from the rest of society. So I have a couple of questions on this. First off, Alex West Leffler, who plays Isla, very young, like how old? Like I think like 11 or 12 or something like that?
Yeah, she was, I believe, 11 when we shot the film, which is, you know, about a year and a half, 2 years ago now.
And this is a really sophisticated role, and it's sort of a dark role as well. So as a director, what conversation did you have with her on how you wanted her to approach this character and what you wanted her to be thinking about?
You know, it's a funny thing with a lot of the best actors, whether they're kids or adults, if they're really good at what they do, you barely have to say anything to them. You know, and especially with kids, they have a great way of not over-intellectualizing things the way adults do. You know, it's not hard to find an actor who can overthink their role. I mean, you want any actor to prepare and put the hard work into bringing the character to life, and that's great. But, you know, with a lot of kids, when you see tapes, suddenly you realize certain kids just have that thing. They're not self-aware, and they say the lines in a way that feels natural. And they're only like one in 500, but when you see the right one, you really glom onto it. And that was the case with Alex. So she just innately understood the character and could perform the lines in a way that felt very naturalistic, didn't feel performative in the way kids often are. So, you know, I've had to say I would like to take credit for her amazing performance, but I had to say very little to her. You know, towards the end of the film, it turns dark. You know, there's a great twist at the end that I think audiences will really enjoy that, you know, was a lot for a young child to deal with. But her parents were always on set, and we had a bunch of conversations about that. We walked it through step by step, and yeah, she really nailed it.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. Coming up, more of my conversation with filmmaker Christian Sparks.
Hi, I'm Willa Paskin, the host of Decoder Ring, Slate's podcast about cracking cultural mysteries. On Decoder Ring, we dive down rabbit holes and obsessively explore questions hiding in plain sight. Like, why has slow dancing gone out of style? And when did we all become obsessed with hydration? And where did the word mullet, you know, to describe a hairstyle, come from? That's Decoder Ring, named one of the best podcasts of 2023 by the New York Times. Listen to new episodes every 2 weeks and make sure to follow us so you never miss one.
As a director, what was the most important thing you needed to get right so the audience believes that this is a real community, albeit an extremely isolated one?
I think, you know, both in performance and visual language, I just aimed for a somewhat naturalistic tone. It would be easy to really give in to genre and make this – like you want the world slightly elevated because it's about a child with magical powers, but you don't want it too elevated. You don't want to lean into genre too far because then the stakes don't feel real. If they don't feel like real people, then when bad things happen, you're not completely attached to these characters. Whereas I wanted the kind of – both the performances and the texture of the world to be very tactile and be the Newfoundland that I knew and loved.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about Kiehl's.
Kiehl's is it's an amazing town. They're getting harder and harder to find in rural Newfoundland.
Where is it? Where is it in Newfoundland?
It's about 3.5 hours away from the capital of St. John's and about a half hour away from another town called Bonavista, which a lot of people know.
Pretty small community, right?
Tiny. I mean, probably like in the height of summer, probably 60 or 70 people.
How did you decide on Kiel's to be the home of this twisted, isolated community?
I had always wanted to shoot in Kiel's. You know, when you're a Newfoundland filmmaker, I've done a lot of work for Newfoundland Tourism, doing those commercials over the years as well. And so I've traveled up and down the province 10 times over. And I'm aware of most of the little towns and inlets. And Kiel's is very special because it's a little bowl that's surrounded by hills. And so it is tucked away from the rest of the world. Even if you're going by in a boat past a narrow harbor, it would be easy to miss. And so I needed that kind of town for the film. And, you know, a lot of these towns, too, it makes sense that they're kind of refurbishing themselves. They have vinyl siding and they kind of modernize themselves. But this one still feels out of time with the painted chipped clapboard and the old weathered stages. So it just had the aesthetic that I thought was perfect for this world.
Some of the locals from the community made it into the film, right?
Absolutely, they did. Yeah, when you watch the film, there's a bunch of town meetings. Anytime you see extras that make up the town, that's all locals from Kiel's. And it just so happens that they have amazing faces on camera. And they were really game to participate. And I mean, you know this. People always say that Newfoundlanders are very friendly. And it makes you want to roll your eyes at times because it's a bit of a cliche. But, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's true. And it was true for this film, too. All this crew came from away, went to this tiny town, and the people of Kiel's cooked them dinner. They took them out on the weekends fishing in their boats. They were extras in the film, and they had to do all this crazy stuff. And they never complained once. They were only too happy to be there.
But before we go, I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, folks who make art and make film in Newfoundland and Labrador. You know, it wasn't that long ago that people started to feel like they had to leave. And you're starting to see that change over the years all across Canada. I spoke to Jeremy Larder not that long ago, who was talking a little bit about trying to establish more filmmaking in on Prince Edward Island. And I know in Newfoundland things have been going for a while, thanks to folks like Paul Pope and Andy Jones and Barb Doran. But I think about young filmmakers now who might be listening to this, who see the work that you're doing and they want to stay in Newfoundland to tell their stories. What do you say to them?
I would say, think about what Newfoundland means to you and you know, choose your lane accordingly. Like for me, and I know you know this, Newfoundland, and I've said this before, is often painted as kind of a cute, colorful, almost parody of itself. And that's great and that served us very well. But I'm much more interested in a darker side of Newfoundland, almost like a Newfoundland Gothic side. That hasn't been explored too much. And so for me, that has given me a lane and given me an interesting avenue to talk about the home and the people that I know and love. And that kind of feels unique. And so I'd encourage other artists and other filmmakers to do the same. It doesn't have to be dark. Whatever Newfoundland is to you, you know, really sit down and think about that and then explore it accordingly.
Christian, congratulations on the film. I absolutely loved it.
Awesome, brother. Well, it's nice to finally meet after all these years, and thanks for having me.
You're the last one on my bingo card of Newfoundland artists I haven't met. It's my conversation with Christian Sparks. His film, The King Tide, is in theaters across Canada. It is a brilliant, dark, disturbing, awesome Newfoundland film. Go, please, please go check it out. The other conversation we have up today is with, I guess, one of the best-selling romance novelists of all time. What's interesting about Emily Henry is not necessarily the number of books she sold. I almost said amount of books she sold. Sorry, Mom. Number of books she sold. It's that she's managed to crack the code and bring romance novels to a generation raised on dating apps, you know, on TikTok and Instagram. And she has a lot to say about why some people in the literary industry sort of thumb their nose at romance novelists and romance novels. Really interesting conversation. She's super funny. Go check that out wherever you got this podcast. We'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.